We were unable to germinate them at this point. Propagation has also got a very low success rate. That's the main obstacle. There's a lot of limitations and things to take into account when working with endangered species. But I mean, I guess that's the point, is science, you've got to take a few risks.
To grow this endangered species, you might just need tiny little gauze gift bags, emu digestive juices, and the essence of smoke. I'm Ann Jones, and who knew that gardening could ever be this bizarre? Let's get straight into this special replay with some of the best sounds of the last year on Off Track. Today, let me introduce you to Catherine Catalotti. She's a technical officer with the Australian Plant Bank at the Sydney Botanic Gardens, and she's studying the snotty gobble, the nodding G-bung, Persoonia nutans.
Persoonia nutans is a bush that gets to about 2 metres high. It's got quite delicate leaves. It's got a nice lime green colour to it. The stems are red. It's quite wiry and wispy. And then it's got these nice droopy fruits that kind of go purple. Yeah.
And what do the flowers look like?
They're little and yellow. They have 4 petals that sort of curve back. They're very similar throughout Persoonias. So most Persoonias have these little yellow flowers. So G-bungs all have the same flowers. Yeah. This one's special because it's endangered. It's from Western Sydney, so it's from an area that is getting a lot of development and a lot of things are happening there, which is great, but it also means that the environment is becoming fragmented, so we have to keep a special eye on those plants. There's one major population left.
What does that mean, major population? Are we talking like a forest of the things?
We're talking a reserve of the things, which is in the Agnes Banks area. It's really unique. That's why it's been made a reserve, because it's probably the best example of the particular community that it's in. If something was to happen to those plants, if there was some sort of disease or a predator or some sort of, you know, effect in the environment there, like a fire came through and they didn't recover from it properly or something, then the plant species would be in a lot of trouble, because they haven't really got backups.
No backups. Remembering that Catalotti works for the Australian Plant Bank, which stores seeds and does a whole heap of research into conserving Australian native plant species. But of course, it's of no use having seeds if you don't know how to grow them.
We're unable to germinate them at this point, and propagation has also got a very, very low success rate. So propagation is where we take a cutting from the plant and then strike it, so give it different hormones that mean it can grow some roots and grow on to become another plant, and so we have low rates of success for both of those things.
So what is to be done? First, collect seeds.
Looking through other people's research and other people's experience, it seems that it's really important for the seeds to be left on the plant for the entirety of their developmental phase. In other words, to let them drop off naturally. So I've put these little mesh bags to try and capture the seeds and let them drop naturally to maximise the amount of viability for each of the seeds and sort of standardise them for experimental work.
They're literally like little gift bags that you might see in a dollar store or something, like made out of gaudy colours generally, the ones that I've seen.
Yeah, hideous colours.
And you literally tie them over the fruit and you have to wait until that little bag is full of all the seedy goodness.
That's right, and then come back and recollect in the bags. So it's a way of excluding them from being eaten by animals, but I'm also finding that the animals are sucking the fruit off the seed through the bag and then leaving me the seed, which is great. So they're still getting their food and I'm getting the seed at the end.
So there's like quite a meaty, fruity covering over this seed, is there?
That's right, yeah, which is part of their importance, is that they put all this energy into creating this nutritional food in an environment which has quite a scarcity of energy for animals.
I'm sort of imagining some sort of plum-like thing.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, they change shape a little bit for different Persoonias, but so our one that we're looking at today is kind of, it's sort of like a mini mango shape.
And have you had luck in collecting your seeds? How have you gone?
Pretty good, actually. I'm pretty impressed, because I Oh, I expected a lot. Yeah, I expected it would be a lot harder, but we're doing pretty well for numbers. And
but of course, it's no use having all of this genetic material, these seeds stored in a seed bank somewhere, if you have no idea how to bring them to life, is it? It's just silly.
Well, I mean, it's no good having them if we don't know how to bring them to life, and it's also no good having them if we don't know how to store them properly. So there's different ways to store seed. I mean, you need to know how to germinate a seed to know whether or not it's alive. And because we don't know whether or not it's alive, we don't know if our storage techniques are actually conserving them or whether or not that's also degrading their viability and their ability to sort of germinate. So the first step is to be able to germinate them and then also to be able to test our different storage techniques to see which one suits them the best.
Think about all of the things that could impact on a seed in the environment. Moisture, fire events, chemicals, interactions with fungus, temperatures, physical processes, and exactly which of those things is important to this seed, the seed of the endangered Pessunia nutans. The mind boggles at the variables, but Catherine Catalotti says we have some clues in the biology of the seed.
There's the fruity exocarp, which is that the fruity bit on the outside, and that the plant would bother to put energy into creating all of that means that, you know, part of their evolution has been to be eaten by animals. So that's a dispersal mechanism. We know that so far. There's research that shows that emus are important for dispersing the Pessunias. However, there may also be importance in the digestion of the seed because the next level under the fruiting structure is an endocarp, which is a hard woody casing, so it's almost like having a bone around, so it's a very protective covering, and that indicates that it's protecting the seed from some other process, some physical process. So digestion may help for scarifying, for scratching it up. It might coat it in a particular chemical from the chemical environment of the stomach, or some sort of microbes from the microbial environment of the stomach, or it could be some other quite dynamic occurrence in the environment like fire. You know, there's a lot of seed pods, especially in Proteaceae, which is the family of Pessunias. You see them sort of crack open like the Banksia. They crack open after a fire.
There are certain types of really delicate orchids and things like that that need fungus in order to actually germinate properly and grow into their mature form. So is there a possibility that it could actually be something in the earth itself that this seed is seeking?
Most definitely it could be, because the only way I've managed to do it so far has been to keep them in a completely sterile environment, because they're so susceptible to fungal growth and it just kills the seed straight away. So there is a potential for symbiotic fungal relationships that protect them from this fungal growth. There's a lot of complexities, which is why this has been such a problem up until now, and why Pessunias have not been included in horticulture and also in restoration.
The nodding geebung is in trouble. Not only are there limited specimens and limited space for those plants, but scientists aren't even sure how to germinate or store the seeds. In the current project at the Australian Plant Bank, Pessunias of many different types, including our Pessunia nutans, the nodding geebung, are being experimented on to try and find out exactly what are the conditions that these seeds might need to be able to germinate. And that leads us to this place, a paddock full of emus. Penny Henley is from Emu Logic.
We're on the edge of the Warren Bungles. We're almost back onto the national park. We've got one neighbour behind us in the national park. It's just really nice basalt country and really good for animals. Yeah, you run emus. We've got about 900, but it is a mixed farming, so we have sheep and cattle as well.
Why emus?
We've got in emus because it's such a good product. The emu oil, we know it helps people with arthritis and eczema and things like that, so, and we've stuck with it for that reason.
And did you have any background in farming birds?
Only chooks and ducks.
So they're like really big chooks and ducks.
Yeah, big chooks. Dumb as, and it basically eat the same thing.
That emu's trying to pick my pocket. Excuse me, that's a very expensive camera. You said that they were a bit dumb, but they're clearly curious.
Oh, they're very curious. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Now feels like he's pinching my bum.
Yep.
So, okay, let's just talk about what we can actually see for a start. They've got a different sort of feather than you would expect on a bird. They're not like a sparrow feather, for example. How do you describe them?
Because they don't fly to touch it. It's more like fur than it is a feather. It's actually a twin feather on one thing, which makes them unique with birds.
So we just got a passing feather. Oh my goodness, they're gorgeous. You know what they look like? They look like moth antenna, fluffy too, but two stalks coming from one base.
Yeah, and that's what makes them unique. Yeah, so that's good insulation.
Okay, some of them we're getting a beautiful colour. Yeah. Of blue, similar to what cassowaries get.
Yeah.
And some of them not. So what's the difference?
Personality. just different birds. All the birds, they have their own hairstyle, they have their own face, so you get to know them because they're all different.
So that's incredible, right? So because some of them have got mohawks, some of them are furry right up to the top of their head. Is that a sign of immaturity or anything like that?
They will change. So these are only 18 months old. They don't really mature till they're 3 years.
Wow.
So they've got a bit more growing to do. I always say at this age they're more like, you know, a 12, 14-year-old. They're getting mature, but they've got a bit more growing out to do. Most of them will come when you call, but not all of them.
My name's Anne Jones. This is Off Track on RN, and it's started to rain at the Emu Farm. It's getting dark, and we're surrounded by milling birds, tall as a human, taller even, and their behaviour is dazzlingly close at hand. Philip Henley.
You see, she's pumped her neck up and got her head back, and she's just parading around, showing off to the males.
And yeah. In fact, her neck, the air bubble that's inside, is bouncing like a bosom, I have to say, isn't it? As she's sort of moving it as she's walking along, it's quite attention grabbing. And so it's only the females that make the sound. And how do they make that sound?
They fill that sac up. They've got a little hole in their esophagus, I suppose, at the bottom of their neck there. They fill the sac up with air, and I suppose it's like a bagpipes, and then they make the booming noise through the sac. They do go quiet at night, except on a moonlit night, they'll go all night, they'll wander around and boom, but from now on they'll start drifting off, and they'll get in little groups, and they'll just huddle in little groups and all go to sleep. Yeah.
If you didn't know you were walking into an emu paddock and you looked off into the distance, you actually wouldn't see a lot of them, because they do just look like rocks, don't they? They're really good camouflage off in the distance.
Yeah, they do blend in. And when they're sitting on the eggs too, they'll lay really flat and low to the ground. They do try to hide. And we've even seen they even pick the grass and put the grass on their backs and that sort of thing. They'll try to camouflage themselves.
What sort of enclosure are we in at the moment?
We're in the yard. It's a holding yard. We just sort of put the emus in to pre-loading.
And for the purposes of this experiment, why are they in here?
So we don't have to go so far to look for their droppings, so they're more contained.
So what do you normally feed them?
A wheat mix, hay, meat meal. They're omnivores, so they do need meat in their diet.
That's really interesting. So in the wild, they'd be taking whatever they could find.
Oh, absolutely. They love grasshopper plagues because they'll eat the grasshoppers. They eat mice. If they come across dead carcass, so you know, even eat the meat off another animal, you'll find a bird which has died in the paddock, and they've been, you know, find some crow feathers, and they're basically eating the crow.
But will they eat the carefully collected seeds of Petunia Newtons that Catherine Catalotti has brought to the farm?
So should we just put them in? Can we do it? Just put them in.
It's like it's a heaving mass of emus.
Feathers and funny heads, yep. Yeah, so they seem to be kind of enjoying it. Last night we did the same, and they ate all the wheat first because that's kind of what they're used to eating. But then by the time we came back the next day, the seeds had gone as well.
So. You've tipped out, what, maybe 1,000 seeds in
probably
there?
About 2,000.
Oh my goodness, yeah. How long did it take you to collect them?
Well, it's taken me probably 6 months, just because I've had to go out and put sort of bags up to collect the seed and then go back to collecting the bags. So they had to actually drop off the plant naturally before. Yeah, it's taken quite a bit of effort.
So how selective are their beaks? I mean, are they, would they be able to pick quite specific things?
Absolutely. They'll walk up behind you and take the back of your earring if you're not careful.
Oh my God. As someone who, you know, makes a living off these animals, these are your livelihood, why get involved in this sort of research?
We'd love to be involved with anything which has got to do with endangered species, be it animals or plants. It's a really important part to help with the environment, keep it as healthy as possible. Particularly when you come to the plants, it's you just don't know what plants will be good for future medicines and things like that. It's like the emu oil, it's really good for medicine stuff too, and a lot of the plants are no different. And it'd be terrible to lose that genetic pool.
Have you ever actually seen the plant?
No, not that we're aware of. There is a similar plant here.
I haven't seen it either yet.
Yeah. Well, we did get to try some seeds. We actually did stir one of the seeds and tried it. Well, we put the seed part back, but ate the fruit off, and they are edible. Yeah. So.
What did it taste like?
Virtually had very little taste at all. It's maybe a little bit like a grape, like a sour grape with not much flavour.
We've been watching as they're picking around the seeds to eat the wheat. Is there things that they particularly like that you can lure them in to eating something that they might not take at first glance?
Basically, their grain mix. Yeah, they're used to it.
So, that's what they'll take, so if you mix it in.
Yeah, they'll basically eat it.
Is it like mixing pumpkin in with the mashed potato for kids who are picky?
Absolutely. Yeah.
What's that like, watching that as a scientist?
Scary and also exciting. Yeah, so there's a few more steps to go before we actually know what the result's going to be. But yeah, it's a good start, that's for sure.
What was it like actually coming to sort through the poo? What did it look like? How did you find it? And how did you sort it?
Okay, so it was pretty... There we go.
Ooh, we've got an example. Perfect timing. Right.
So it's sort of... It's quite soft. It's got quite... I guess they're eating the straw off the ground a little bit because it seems to have bits of straw mixed through. It's got some whole grains of wheat in it and some petunia seeds. Yeah, so it sort of looks like horse manure, I guess, doesn't it?
It does look a little bit like it, though not as large in volume. Can you see any of your seeds in that?
Can I see any of my seeds? Well, possibly not in this one, but we collected some before that had... There's one. Oh, yeah, so there's a seed.
Oh, wow. Okay, so they've digested a fair bit.
Yeah, and there's a...
Of stuff off it because it's much smaller.
Yeah, so that's the endocarp, which is what's inside the fruiting area, which is the exocarp.
Do you think that one pass through an emu might be enough?
Well, actually, I just, because I'm learning about emus obviously now, because it's not my specialty, but apparently they re-eat a lot of their food, so maybe it needs a few times to go through. Yeah, I'm not sure. Mm. That's another
conundrum. So many questions. Yeah. Now comes the exciting bit where you have to actually do things to the poo to get the seed out. So
exciting.
Such an exciting part of science. But I mean, it's actually sort of important. What are you actually going to do? Have you got a plan yet about how you're going to process some of these seeds?
Yep. So basically, we have a bunch of very lovely volunteers who are going to assist with just picking the seeds out of the scouts, out of the poo. We're hoping to kind of keep them sort of covered in the remnants, so not wash them off or anything like that. And then we'll be sowing them into seed raising trays in a nursery.
How long do you think it'll take before we might see some germination?
Well, if I have enough seeds, I'll be cracking some of them and not cracking others. The ones that will be cracked would germinate a lot quicker. The ones that remain uncracked will take a lot longer. So the ones that will be cracked will probably take within a month, a couple of weeks, 6 weeks, something like that. The ones that remain uncracked could take another couple of months for them to work through the physical process of that casing breaking down a bit.
And what will it be that will break through your little soil patches in hopefully lots of numbers? What will what will that actually look like?
So they're really interesting as germinants because they have 5 to 7 cotyledons, which spread open like a weird palm tree or a little alien. So it's a singular shoot with these 5 or 7 little fingers that stick out, and then from the center of that will come up the true leaves. So we'll rise, like true leaves will rise from the center. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
That's really, that sounds quite unusual.
Yeah, they're very unusual in that way. Yep.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So hopefully we'll see hundreds of them in the near future, if not thousands, all of them germinating.
Millions.
But I mean, we joke because, you know, we're dealing with scats and these huge animals that are very characterful. But I mean, how critical is this project for this species?
Well, the main goal is to be able to set up rescue populations, to include them in horticulture, and also to be able to include them in restoration projects, as well as to be able to store them properly and appropriately so that we have germplasm stored of this species in case, as a safe wall, in case something was to happen.
A worst case scenario, what's that?
Worst case scenario will be back to the drawing board. So I guess worst case scenario will be taking off these ideas as ways of making it work, excluding these variables as a way of germinating these seeds. So finally understanding that the emus are not actually what these seeds require, and then we'll be back at the drawing board and looking at fire-related cues and other ecological cues. Yeah.
One of the interesting things about fire cues is that it's not necessarily the heat that's the effective factor.
Smoke has probably over 100 different compounds in it, some of which kerikenolides in particular have been identified as effective for germination of seeds, especially of South African and Australian plants. They use fire as a signal. So what I'll be doing is I have an aqueous solution, a water solution. Basically, I've smoked some water. I've put smoke through water to capture a lot of those compounds in a solution. I'll be imbibing the seeds, which means, you know, putting the seeds in that water. There's a number of big changes that come from a fire. So one is increased nutrients in the soil because there's a lot of burnt organic matter, which then through water comes through into the soil. And Australia is very poor, it's got very poor nutrient soils because we haven't got any volcanoes or any sort of geological activity that's rejuvenating the soils. So that's a really good opportunity for plants, especially when they've got to do a big burst of growing from a seed. So they take advantage of that. These plants take around 7 years to become sexually mature. So they want as big a gap as possible between the next fire and growing from seed so that they can get to that stage, create more seed before the next fire and continue on as part of their life history. Then the other aspect is, of course, less competition. So there is more space, there's less canopy up above. They can grow up and establish themselves.
And the environmental variables that could have an impact on seed germination don't stop there.
We'll be using gibberellic acid, so growth hormones, to see if that breaks dormancy. We're looking at temperature, you know, optimal temperatures for germination, basic optimal temperatures. But then on top of that, we're also looking at stratification, which is where you expose a seed to one temperature and then take it down to a cold temperature so it feels like it's going through a season, and then take it back up and then it'll, you know, that can sometimes break dormancy as well.
Wow, so you're essentially creating, you know, sort of like a year, a year in a short amount of time.
In a short amount of time.
So you're tricking it.
Yeah.
You guys are a bit funny
tricksters.
With these seeds, aren't you?
Yeah. And there's some seeds that require a particular difference between the temperatures, so a minimum of 10 degrees, for example.
Wow.
Or, yeah, so we have to sort of, yeah.
So many variables. So in a way, this project that you're doing at the moment is taking a whole range of stimulus that could be the linchpin to this Parsonia germinating and basically ticking them off in a scientific way to see what it is that is the key process that needs to happen for germination. So you've got this broad swathe of stuff, temperature, fire, water, emus, the whole shebang, cracking, not cracking.
Heat as well, heat shock from fire, so heat shock.
Yep. Yeah, so what do you do with them for the heat shock?
Basically expose them to a short-term
burst of heat. So when a fire goes through, it'll heat up the soils which have all the seeds in them. So that might also be a signal. That might also be what cracks open the endocarp, and it might signal germination.
So do you basically put it in an oven?
Yeah, basically you put it in an oven for a short period of time and that's it.
So how much have you got riding on this project?
So much. What a terrible question. What have I got riding on it?
How is it when you're dealing with an endangered species? Is it possible to keep personally out of it?
Not really, because you have a particularly, you know, there's a lot of sort of limitations and things to take into account when working with endangered species. You don't want to sort of make more of a problem by doing this research than there already is. So it makes you value the fact that you've got these seeds a lot more than if it was a common species. For this project, I have there's a number of common species also included, and I'm sort of using them as the workhorse species that I can use for my more basic experiments to just try and, you know, I can use more. They're more expendable, and I have a different attitude towards them. Not that I don't appreciate them, but you know, they're not. It's not the same as working with endangered species, definitely.
Yeah. Which brings us to the emus, yeah. Right? So here we are in northwestern New South Wales at an emu farm. What's it like now, being someone who's worked for quite some time on this plant, to actually see all of those seeds that you collected going through the digestive tract of a large animal?
Oh, it's pretty nerve-wracking. But, I mean, I guess that's the point is science. You've got to take a few risks to be able to kind of investigate these things.
The workers at Murrumbidgee Provenance Nursery, an Aboriginal run nursery near where the seeds were collected, have been spending many hours sorting out the emu scat from the seeds. And Catherine Catalotti tells me she's just about to start the experiments to see what conditions the seeds need to germinate. And I'll do my best to keep you informed right here on Off Track about how those nodding G-bung trials go. Thanks also to Philip and Penny Henley from Emu Logic for speaking with me and letting me loose in the emu paddock with the recording gear, and to Catherine Catalotti, a technical officer with the Australian Plant Bank. My name is Anne Jones and this is Off Track, the national radio show which brings the outdoors inside to you every week here on ABC RN. And if you're into plant biology or gardening, I've got plenty of stories in the back catalogue for you, including an absolute ripper on sexually deceptive orchids. You can subscribe to the podcast via most of the podcast apps these days or listen to it direct from the ABC Radio website. Remember to wipe off your boots before you come inside, but do meet me here at the same time next week. That's when I'll take you somewhere else.